Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Welcome back to Bad Movies Rule, and today we've got, well, what some might argue isn't necessarily a bad movie, but we're going to get into all that. We are talking about The Fifth Element. Let's go. Welcome in, guys. How you doing?
Fantastic, especially after that theme song. That was amazing.
That was a nice tune. I like that.
I didn't write it. It literally was like a preloaded tune that came with the studio.
Well, excellent selection.
I pressed the first button when I sat down. I can use this, right? And
it
that
works.
Was that.
It works.
It works. It works fine. So you might not recognize the two voices that you've just heard. So let me introduce them. We have Nicole Freer in the house with us for the first time ever. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you very much. What an honor.
Nicole is an old friend. We've been doing stuff together since, 2006?
That actually probably is exactly the year.
Yeah. And stuff doesn't really mean a whole lot. We've been doing... We've done shows and movies and sketches and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So what are you doing these days, Nicole? Where can the people at home find you?
They can find me on Instagram or Twitter, Nicole.Freer, if they want to find me on Instagram.
Awesome.
And Nicole regular Freer, because there's no dot on Twitter. It's very confusing. thanks, platforms. So I teach and do improv at the Improv Playhouse in Libertyville, but I'm doing a show called Wisecrackin' on wisecrackin.com, which is online virtual comedy game show, and it's super fun. Friday nights, 8 o'clock Central on the interwebs.
Awesome. And then to Nicole's left, we have Jesse Hurst joining us also for the first time. Jesse and I have only met, 3 years ago now, 2018?
That sounds about right. Honestly, time's been weird these past couple of years.
Well, since COVID, what does time mean anymore?
Nothing. It means nothing now.
Yeah, but Jesse, also, we met doing a show together, Noises Off, back in 2018. What are you doing these days, Jess? What have you been up to?
These days, I am actually a full-time college student going back to get my degree to be a history teacher, although right now I also, you can catch me streaming on Twitch late night.
There you go.
Playing a variety of different games and just kind of chatting. I'm also on Twitter, jhus87.
Is that the both for Twitch and Twitter?
Or Twitter has the 87.
Yeah.
Twitch does not.
Okay. Got it. Awesome. Well, we'll have to definitely check that out. And then joining us, I don't know, joining us, you also heard him, because I don't think you've said anything yet. Say hi, Brady.
Hello, Brady.
Brady Cox is back with us again. You've heard him before, all the way from Omaha, Nebraska. We're excited to have you back. And today, guys, we're talking about The Fifth Element. And the reason we're talking about The Fifth Element is Jesse himself.
I just want to throw in here, I know the title of the podcast is Bad Movies Rule, but I'm going to argue that The Fifth Element is not only not a bad movie, but technically speaking, is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Well, that's a strong take.
It is a strong take. It's a strong take. And when I say technically speaking, what I mean is from a technical standpoint.
Yeah.
As a film, it is perfectly put together.
Wow. Okay. I think this movie, and I thought about, does it qualify, right, first of all? And the more I kind of looked into it, this movie exists in a really weird space in that I found it on lists of greatest sci-fi movies of all time. And then I've seen multiple, internet newspapers, we'll call them, right? List them on the worst sci-fi movies of all time. So it's, I don't know where this exists within, you don't hear it talked about much when people are talking about, the best sci-fi movies.
I will say this, as far as bad movies go, it was made on a $90 million budget and it made only $17 million in the U.S.
Oof.
So it was definitely a bomb. At least in theaters.
Yeah. Why was that, do you think? What is it about it that just the marketing standpoint, they didn't market it well enough, or what do you think?
Well, I think part of the problem is that it originally debuted at Cannes. Mm. And until fairly recently, films that have debuted at Cannes have not done particularly well in the United States. They're generally more art house, and that's just not been particularly popular here.
Because this wasn't an American film.
It was not. Luc Besson is French.
Right. And so this wasn't a Hollywood picture. And I think for the time, the budget for, was one of the biggest for a non-Hollywood feature film. That kind of almost set it up for the way they brought it out, the fact they'd put so much money into it. You think they'd set themselves up, to be behind the eight ball right away?
Well, I mean, they had Bruce Willis, who was a huge star at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that should have done something for them.
Yeah. Well, as you said, let's get the vitals out of the way. This movie was directed by Luc Besson, who one could say is maybe arguably more well-known as a writer than a director. I mean, he's directed a handful of well-known movies, but
I feel like I want to pronounce it Luc Besson. Because
I think that would probably be correct.
Feel free to do that.
I'm not sure, but I'm going to.
At all times. Sorry, Luke. Luc Besson.
Luc Besson.
Oh
my gosh. Luc Besson. Luc Besson.
It fits. I think he directed, La Femme Nikita was him, right? Or
I believe so. Yep. And also the recent Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which actually had the graphic novel of that had a huge influence on The Fifth Element.
Well, there you go. I think my favorite thing that he's probably ever written was the Taken movie, not necessarily the Taken series.
I didn't know he wrote that.
He wrote 2008's Taken. And this movie was co-written. He has a frequent collaborator, Robert.
It's going to be French today.
Quemon. I'm going to guess that's how you say his name. He has co-written almost everything Luke's written. They kind of write stuff together. But Brady, I don't know if you knew this, but something that Robert came and wrote on his own was the Karate Kid movies.
Sweeps the leg.
So I got the guy.
They can't all be winners, man.
No, so. But I'm just saying this movie was written by the guy that wrote Taken and the guy that wrote Karate Kid. Why isn't it more beloved?
I do have a note further on my little phone list here that talks about how just phenomenal the action sequences are in this movie.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Right.
Absolutely. The movie starred John McClane, the girl from Resident Evil, Gary Oldman, and Bilbo Baggins. So it had a really great cast.
Why does Gary Oldman not get his own character? Why not
Commissioner Gordon?
Commissioner Gordon,
I don't know, because he's Gary Oldman. I just didn't want to drop the disrespect on him by saying it. But I get, no, it's Bruce Willis. I always say her name wrong. I always say her
Mia,
name.
Mia Jovovich.
Mia Jovovich, right? Yeah. Famously from the Resident Evil series, Gary Oldman and Ian Holm, who was the original Bilbo Baggins before Martin Freeman. So extremely well cast, to your point. Great writer, great director. This should, by all accounts, be an all-time classic.
We also can't forget Luke Perry.
Oh, yeah. I should have said in the kid from 90210.
Who is completely irrelevant and is only in the film 10 minutes.
That's right.
And yet somehow gets his name on the title card.
He did. Before in the opening credits.
Yeah.
Nicole.
Yes.
When you were 16 years old, if you had written a movie at that age, what do you think that movie would have been about?
Wow. So I didn't prepare this in advance.
That's okay.
So how old would I have been again?
16 years old.
There would be definitely some cats in it and sweet musical numbers.
Yeah.
So cats.
So cats. With cats and musical numbers.
Yeah. I mean, I like action in movies, actually.
Yeah.
I guess this one did not have any yippee-ki-yays, which is probably what I think is the big issue, which is why it didn't do as well.
Right.
And nobody jumping out of a tall New York kind of building, I guess.
It does. Right? It does have that.
I guess. Well, what city is it? Is it
New York?
It is New York.
New York, or is it just New York?
I don't know.
Am I thinking Futurama?
No, well, I was thinking of Judge Dredd at first. But that was like, this is exactly the same footprint as New York. It's just like 100 feet higher up in the air.
Yeah, it's built vertically.
Right. Brady, when you were 16 years old, if you had wrote a movie, what would your movie have been about?
I have no idea. It probably would have been science fiction of some sort.
Yeah?
Maybe space vampires. I don't know.
All right. So we got Cats, the musical, space vampires. Yes. What about you, Jesse?
I don't know. That's a really tough question.
The point I'm making by asking this is it's to me super impressive. Luc Besson, did I do it right?
I think so.
Wrote this when he was 16 years old.
No.
Yes.
Shut the front door.
Yes.
I did not know that. I should know that. I didn't know that.
He wrote, now he did other movies before he actually made the film, right? I mean, it wasn't his first film, but he, way back in the day, created the world, the aliens, thought it all up in his head. And wrote, I'm sure the first draft was rough. But he essentially created it when he was in high school. That's really impressive to me. You
know, maybe now that you're saying that, I guess I would have written a diatribe about the human condition.
Okay, yeah, right, of course.
Something.
Right, a deconstruction of science fiction.
Having given it some thought, I can now say my movie would have been an X-Men knockoff.
I think I actually wrote, I was trying to write a movie when I was in high school, and it got like 5 pages in, you know, how it worked. And it was about terrorists taking over our high school. It was basically toy soldiers that I just totally ripped off. And of course, there's no reason for terrorists to come and take over our high school. But that's what I wrote. But this guy thought up, while I'm doing that and you're thinking about cats and we're, you know, whatever else, this guy thought up the fifth element. He was destined to be a big time writer, is all I'm trying to say.
Sweet.
True genius.
Yeah. So let's talk. And Brady, I'll start with you. What's your overall vibe you get from this movie?
I think it's important that it's not a Hollywood movie, mainly because just the feel of the movie is just so different. I also like that because we're in the far future, plus we're in outer space. So these things should feel foreign to us. And the fact that it was made in a foreign country, I think, added to that quite a bit.
So to you, the thing that stands out is that it all just doesn't quite feel right, or familiar, rather.
Correct. Yeah, there's really nothing. There's not a lot familiar. I mean, there's, you know, the whole, you know, like when he gets in the cab, like, you know, sure, there's all this cool future technology, but it's dirty. The letters are fading off the buttons, you know, things like that, which were great touches, mm-hmm. by the way. I mean, the world is very lived in, something that a lot of sci-fi movies overlook because it's in the future. Everything's perfectly clean all the time. Mm-hmm.
Right, because that's the way we're heading.
Right, definitely.
Right, exactly. This movie doesn't make that mistake. It's there's still grime, there's still crime, there's still, you know, the fog at the bottom. You don't want to live in the bottom of the city.
Piles of garbage in the airport.
Oh yeah, that's true. Nicole, how about for you? What's your general impression when you watch this movie?
My first note is it makes me want to go out and buy a lot of bright orange duct tape because I have a lot of costumes to make and I keep forgetting.
You liked Lee Lu's costumes in this movie?
I mean, it seemed problematic for running, but it seemed like it's really future-y, right?
The thermal bandages is actually a really popular cosplay.
Yeah. Is that her first? The first outfit.
It's just the white and it's, right. It covers like nothing.
The straps.
Yeah. The straps, yes. Yeah.
So mine will be a little different.
As you say, thermal bandages.
That's what they call them in the movie. That is the proper title. Yeah.
That's supposed
bandages.
To keep heat in?
Allegedly.
She's like an amazing alien. There's no need for realism. For
right,
that.
Because I feel like the heat's going to escape in that outfit. It's just what I think.
Yeah.
She has 200,000 mammo groups, whatever that means.
Whatever. I love mumbo jumbo, like made up sci-fi, right? Mumbo jumbo. Movies is my favorite thing.
Yeah, the flux capacitor is the best part of that car he's in, by the way.
When they just make up stuff, yes. It's just, but they do it and they deliver it with such sincerity. Oh, I love, I don't know. It's just a little thing for me. I just love that kind of stuff.
The other thing is for me, it's multiple movies kind of smashed together, mm-hmm. types. So the end part feels very different from the beginning and the middle. And I know obviously you need to have some kind of continuation, but it just seems to me like there were about 3 chunks that were assembled.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're wrong at all.
I agree completely. That actually goes into it being the perfectly built film.
Okay, so yes. So what? I know it's your favorite movie of all time, but why? What is it about? If you just from an overall like Goodyear blimp view standpoint, what is it you love about it so much?
Oh man, it has something for everyone. Mm. There is anyone who watches this movie can look at it and find something that they say, you know, I really liked that. Nicole, you really liked the costumes. Brady, okay. you enjoyed that kind of. Disassociated feel where it's not really connected. I really love everything about it. But what about you?
The thing that, and I hadn't seen this movie in years. I watched it maybe twice, once when it came out, maybe again a couple years later. But then there's been a big break for me, you know, going back to revisit it. And the thing that I found myself drawn to is more, it was Lee Lu above everything else, and really the chemistry that she had with Bruce. I hesitate to even say romance or love story because there isn't really, when you look at it objectively, it's kind of paper thin. They don't really devote a lot of time in the film to building that out other than,
Don't. And yet, despite that, you can tell that there's something there. It's magical. It's amazing performance.
Yeah. And so I think maybe it's just the time of your life when you see something. I don't think that's what I took away from it when I was 20 years old, you know, and I was probably more interested in Bruce Willis blowing aliens away. Right. You know what I mean? Which is still fun and I still enjoy. But she, Mila in this movie is magnetic. And so I've never been a big fan of hers, but after the movie, I literally went on IMDb and I went back and I was like, what other movies has she been in and what can I go see and watch? Because I just thought she was incredible in this movie. And I don't know how I missed the boat on her 25 years ago.
I'll be honest. This is her best movie.
Yeah. Okay. So I should just not waste my time.
No. I mean, you can. Like, so I also really, when I look at a movie, I'm not like looking at it to analyze it. I'm always going to be entertained. So for me, I look at something like the Resident Evil franchise, which most people would be like, oh, that's hot garbage.
Yeah.
And I love it. I love every single second of it.
Yeah.
But so I do love a lot of Mia Jovovich's movies, but this one is easily, in my opinion, her best one.
Yeah.
I am a little biased because it is my favorite movie.
Well, that's not surprising because if it's her best movie, I wouldn't be surprised, I guess is what I'm saying, because she was that good in this that I can't imagine. It had to maybe even been frustrating for her to come out of the gate at this level, and then maybe she chased it for her whole career. I mean, I don't know.
I can't remember if this was her second or her fifth movie, but it was pretty early on in her career.
Right. I know she had already done Dazed and Confused. I think, I don't know, she had a big part in that, and she had done a couple of other things, but this was definitely her first big star vehicle.
Yeah.
Right?
It's probably pretty hard to find a movie like this again, by the way. I'm sure a lot of things getting thrown at her were romances of some kind or another, because that's what this was partially pitched as, right?
So especially at the time that the movie was made, there weren't a whole lot of female action heroes.
Right.
No, so from an actress's standpoint, right, this is a real meaty part. I mean, just think of like the physicality of the whole thing, and she's got to deliver this made up language with sincerity, and you get a chance to do all kinds of things where she's probably getting a lot of girl's best friend or rom-coms or like that kind of stuff thrown at her all the time.
And what I love about her portrayal here is how she really didn't seem to be judging the craziness that was required from the role. I mean, the same with Chris Tucker, right? With his own character, but they went big and they weren't afraid of it. And I think some would have toned it down, but probably that's why she was cast, right?
And beyond just her performance, I think the other thing that stuck out to me about this movie is just how bright and colorful it is. I think, and I didn't find out till after I read up on it afterwards, but that was intentional on Luc Besson, his part, was that so many sci-fi films were like, he didn't want to have a dark hallway where you can't see the actors and everything's dingy and crusty. And he's like, let's have a bright, vibrant, you know, future.
But still dingy and crusty.
But still lived in, right? Yeah, exactly. But like, you can see people. They're wearing things like orange and pink and all that stuff, which I thought
was very
really cool.
Neon. It's very cyberpunk is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's honestly, when I saw that game, I don't know if you've played Cyberpunk 2077 yet. I haven't played it, but I've seen a lot of it. I'm waiting until I have the system it actually runs on.
You want a Series X for that. Trust me. Yeah. I know I've got one.
As opposed to the one that'll like choke and die while it's trying to run the game. But yeah, I thought of The Fifth Element immediately when I saw that. Well, let's get into the beats of the movie. And as we go through this, we're going to just kind of walk through.
If we're going to start from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
This is kind of meta, but the last Bruce Willis movie we did starts out with a guy on a donkey.
That's true. Hudson Hawk. Yes.
And I noticed that immediately. It was like, what's the deal with Bruce Willis and donkeys?
You think he just opens the script and he's like, I'll do it. Anytime there's a guy on a donkey on the first page.
I don't know how that wouldn't be the case.
I don't know. Maybe he feels like this is going to be a real serious picture because they're starting it off.
And then it turns into Nacho Libre.
Right. Well, because at Hudson Hawk, it was like in Italy, the Renaissance. And now it's starting back in the 1914 in Egypt. And he just is really impressed by that, I guess, whenever we're starting in an old flashback. I'm in. Yeah. So what's interesting about this is there's a 12-minute opening sequence with the 90210 guy and these giant fat aliens.
The Mondashi ones.
Yeah, so it's a bold move to start your movie with 12 minutes of exposition, essentially, without anybody that's going to be in the movie for the rest of the time, you know, and expect people to hang on while you get to it, so to speak. What'd you guys think of that opening sequence?
I love it.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very awesome. It's like, you know, you're showing up to watch a space movie, and then you're like, why are we in Egypt in 1900 or whatever?
1914.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1914. Okay. Why are we here? And then, you know, there's the Aziz Light bit, which is great. Everybody loves that, right? Yep. And it's just like, what are we doing? Oh, okay, we got hieroglyphics. Okay, is this Stargate? What are we doing? And then we get right in, like, spaceship shows up, and you're just like, okay, I'm in.
Well, the character design of the first alien species you see, how's it pronounced?
Mandashiwans.
The Mandashiwans it drew me right in immediately. I was like, oh, these guys look awesome. This is going to be fantastic.
And then you see them one more time, and that's it.
That's it, right? But how I actually took a little bit of comedy out of the scene. Like, how frustrating would it be? That guy scraping at that wall for however long he's been there, trying to decide. And this guy just walks in with a key, and just the whole thing opens up. And it's you just suddenly come to the realization that you know practically nothing. And
this does not build off of what you just said, and I apologize for that. But
no,
I,
it's okay.
I just love how incredibly quotable this movie is. Like, Aziz Light, like Brady yeah. mentioned earlier, that's something I say on at least a weekly basis when I need something to be brighter.
See,
that's just one example of many from this movie.
And I just love the little touches, right? Like, Luke Perry is, for some reason, so bored, he's keeping track of how often this guy is saying, Aziz Light.
Doodling a boat.
I thought Nuke Perry.
Yep, that's him.
That's a different movie.
That's still
Toxic Avenger.
Oh, he should have done that. Luke Perry is Nuke Perry.
There's still time.
There's not.
They could repackage anything.
I thought for sure he was going to get killed.
I just want to know.
There's nothing to, I mean, it's, there's a lot of times in this movie where it's just like, did they kill that person or didn't they? I don't know.
The archaeologist.
Yeah, like, is that guy dead? Did he kill him?
We don't know.
Knock him unconscious?
We don't know.
Are these Luke things, Perry thinks so.
Are these things benevolent? They're portrayed to be.
I also don't understand. It seems just the way Luke Perry moves in that scene, mm-hmm. like for some reason he's blind all of a sudden. Like, he's waving his arms around like, I can't see anything. And what is that?
Yeah, I don't know. It was a choice.
I love this movie, but I have questions.
He's making some bold acting decisions there, right? And, you know, if Luc Besson just let him ride, then that's what you got. Or you don't take the shackles off Luke Perry and not expect some big, bold acting choices. All right, so then here's the thing where they go even a little bit further into this. They're, even after that big 12-minute opening scene, they go into yet another expositional scene for another, like, 4 or 5 minutes with the president. And you're played by Tiny Lister.
Who I love. That's just brilliant.
He's okay, so you like that? Because I thought he was miscast.
He's awful.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
He's awful, and it's amazing.
Okay, so you think that was a purposeful choice?
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, that was definitely a purposeful choice. It's showing that in the future, like, whatever your preconceived notions are today are not what they are in the future, right? I'm just saying, they don't look at this guy and think, oh, this guy's just an idiot. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, he just didn't seem very presidential. And from a casting standpoint, I thought this movie was impeccably cast. I thought he was the only one that maybe was a misfire from a casting standpoint. But if it was intentional, then...
I mean, obviously, we are not Luc Besson, so we don't know for sure. But I do think it was intentional. I think he was chosen for the reasons Brady said, and also because it's just completely,
yeah.
like Brady said earlier, out of what you would find comfortable.
Yeah.
Like, here's this ginormous man who was a wrestler in WWE, for crying out loud.
He was.
And here he is being president in, what was it, 300 years, so like,
yeah,
2300s.
Yeah, it almost reminded me of Macho Camacho in
Idiocracy.
In Idiocracy, yeah. Right? I mean, that was, you know, obviously he's not quite as over the top, but... Yeah, I think this scene also introduces the one, and I don't have many problems with the film. I think overall it's good. To me, I think maybe the thing that holds it back, you know, movie fans at large from being an all-time classic is a lack of a really strong villain in the movie. And this evil fire planet, it's like they try their best to explain what this is, and they're trying to set up the threat in the beginning of the film. And
human minds can't comprehend
right,
it. That's
right. What I don't know. I just felt like that for me was weak, but I don't know.
I would argue that despite being the primary threat,
yeah,
I wouldn't consider him to be the primary antagonist.
Right, but even Zorg and Bruce Willis never share a scene together.
Which is brilliant.
You think so?
I do. Another one that's done very intentionally, despite the fact that they interact with each other without interacting with each other throughout the whole movie. They never are in the same shot at the same time.
Right, which you're right, is clearly intentional. They wouldn't have done that by accident. In fact, they have that shot where they just miss each other, right, as they're getting in the elevator, and then he's coming around the other side. But audiences like to have that bad guy, good guy face off at some point. And maybe, I'm just saying, maybe that's a reason why people aren't on this movie, you know, as much as others.
Could be.
It could be. I mean, I don't know. That's just, I just would have liked to have seen one scene or maybe, you know, something with more of a threat that was more of a human threat, I guess is what I'm saying. Brady.
Oh, go ahead, Brady.
Yeah. Let's talk a second about the casting of just the side parts here.
Yeah.
Right. This commander and the ship, you know, these facing off against this, you know, fire planet or whatever. That's Baron Munchausen.
It is. Yes.
I mean, and you go through this movie and there's like, you know, the guy from Mouse Hunt is in the movie later. Just a real short bit part. These guys are amazing and they're just in for, you know, seven lines or whatever. And honestly, it's actually quite, when we find somebody who's not quite as strong, it's very glaring, like, you know, Zorg's henchmen or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they're not as good of actors. But I kind of think that adds to their, you know, ineptitude.
Sure.
in some ways. But yeah, it's just amazing that we get this, again, this guy doesn't have seven lines and he's been in, you know, some major movies playing the lead.
That's true.
It's a really great job on the casting.
No, folks. I agree. I agree. It's impeccably cast. Nicole, were you going to say something before?
Just that with Bruce Willis, I think people did come to really like just seeing him squint slightly at someone when he was angry and ready to fight. And there wasn't a lot of pre-fight squinting.
No, you're right.
So I think that might have been part of it.
Pre-fight squinting was at a minimum in this movie. It was.
That's my new improv team name.
pre-fight squint.
Hello, Shippelagan. Yeah, pre-fight squinting.
And if that's what you want, you'll have plenty of it here. Yeah, so we also meet Ian Holm in this first scene. And like you said, he does great in this movie, great casting. But we're 16 minutes into the movie before we meet Corbin Dallas. 16 minutes. A Hollywood movie would never do that. Never. I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying it's maybe part of what you're saying, Brady, about it just doesn't feel, you know, like familiar, like a Hollywood film, because that was definitely something that was different. And thank God they did the exposition with his character more naturally, right? Where you're kind of left to see, it's on the phone, but you also see like his Medal of Honor on the shelf and all that stuff. Because man, if we had gotten a third exposition dump scene in a row, I don't know if I could have made it past another one.
Brilliantly put together film with brilliant visual storytelling.
See, you're getting proven right at every turn, Jesse. I'm not saying you're wrong, but they already, and this is the other nice thing from a writing standpoint, in that first scene he's on the phone, they're already planting the seed of him not having matches, right? And he's trying to find something. And it turns out that, you know, having that last match turns out to be very, very valuable.
Again,
in the end.
Brilliantly put together film.
Everything gets called back.
It's all interconnected. The interconnectedness of this movie is like nothing I've seen in cinema before or since.
Wow.
I would say that's the theme of the movie, really. I mean, we're all interconnected. It's all this, you know, nothing is chance. Everything is meaningful kind of a thing.
Even if we're blue or...
That's right.
And singing with giant rocks somewhere inside of you.
You know what? A part you'd been perfect for, by the way.
You know what? I will take it.
I'm sitting here going, you know, Nicole could definitely play this part. You kind of looked like the actress too, I feel like.
You honestly, all you would have had to do is be there. They hired a German actress and she never showed up.
Right.
So Luc Besson's then wife, I think, took the part.
Yeah. Wow. He's like, honey, you want to be in a movie? Or, but he did that, but French. Right.
Sure, exactly. Yeah,
right.
How much blue paint do I need to wear?
Right. So the plot now finally starts to kick in here. We have the, and I always say their names wrong, the men, Mandashewins.
Manashevitz, no.
Are coming in, right? Ian Holm has explained, don't worry, these people have all the answers and they're going to come in and save us. And the president's like, cool, bring them in. Except when they're coming in with the Supreme Being, they are shot to pieces by these lip people.
Mangalores.
I was going to say Mandalores, but that's Star Wars. That's very close. Mandalores. These guys look like they're made out of just two big giant lips, basically.
Fun fact, and I only know this because I watched it with the fact sheet on last night.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, in order to play a Mangalore, you had to have a very sloped forehead.
Really?
Yes, in order to fit into the prosthetic costume.
So someone that had carried that sloped forehead their entire life as a badge of shame had said, my moment has arrived.
Boom.
Or maybe they never felt ashamed of it.
That's true. That's true.
You should be proud of who you are.
Right.
Absolutely. But now it was getting you into a movie as a lip alien. Right? These things, I loved how they looked. And I liked that, you know, they could make themselves look human, but they weren't really great at it. I mean, that always makes for great comedy too. So they shoot down this ship and all is lost, but they're able to salvage. So what was that, like a fist or what? Or what is that? That piece of the supreme being that they're able to?
That is definitely the hand down.
Right. But it doesn't look like, and that they put that into a machine. I don't remember what the machine is called.
It doesn't matter what it's called. It 3D prints people.
The flux capacitor.
The flux capacitor printer, person printer. And that hand doesn't look like what we get. So I'm assuming that the supreme being is taking a new form here.
I think it's hard to really answer that. But
yeah.
I think that the reason the hand looks so weird is because it's also encased in metal. Like the whole supreme being is encased in metal initially. So I think what you're seeing there is the hand gripping onto that little metal casing, and then she lets it go. However,
right.
I will say we never see that piece of metal again. It's not in that machine for the rest of the shot.
You're right. It dissolves. And because it needed to for the plot. That leads me to another question that I missed back before. So when they find the fifth element in that cave in Egypt, and it's like kind of looking towards the sky with its mouth open, which again, they call back to at the end of the movie, she's in there?
Correct.
Question mark?
Consider her like Han Solo frozen in carbonite.
Wow.
Right.
There's another Han Solo, Han Solo.
Reference?
Parallel.
Yeah,
okay. Just whenever they're waiting to get on the ships and they're trying to get into it. Just like in Solo, trying to get past the guys to get onto the ships to get to the special place.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. That's one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. It's hard. It's got to be hard to make a sci-fi movie and not end up doing one or two things like a guy named Lucas did before, right? I mean, he's covered so much of the ground, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I feel like here they were trying to go completely the opposite way. So this is when we're introduced to Mila Jovovich.
Mila
Jovovich.
We can call her Mila.
All right. So let's talk about her for a minute. I know we did that a little bit already, but just in this first scene, you've got to start. You're like first day of shooting. I don't know if this is what they shot the first day, but we're just going to say it was. And like, okay, we're going to put you in this glass tube and you have to convulse. And then you have to scream in random language and then...
Oh, it's not random.
Well, I know they made one. Yeah, which we'll talk. Yeah, let's get into that too. But how impressed were you guys with what she was able to accomplish in this movie?
Honestly, anytime I see they made up a language and taught it to someone,
yeah.
I'm just automatically impressed. And just everything about her in this first scene when we first meet her is incredible. I mean, we're introduced to her and we have no idea what she's saying at all.
Right.
And yet, on some level, you kind of understand her.
You can't take your eyes off of her.
Yeah.
And it's not because of what she's wearing, okay?
It's not not because of what
she's
wearing.
It's not because of what she's wearing.
Because she's a captivating actress.
But it is a captivating moment in the film. What do you think about her performance in general, Brady?
I think it's great because, you know, I think a lot of people left this movie thinking that she was some person that did not speak English at all or very well. She just pulls off this, sure, I don't speak English, but I'm going to learn real quick because I'm the supreme being. There's just a lot of strength and innocence. And it's just like, this part is going to be hard for anybody to play. And it doesn't look hard.
No.
She does a good job.
Well, to pull a quote straight from the movie,
yeah,
she really is perfect.
She is. I don't know. I was just totally blown away. And maybe it wasn't acting on Bruce Willis's part, but I kind of felt like he did, like when she falls into his cab, okay, right after this, she escapes, jumps out, falls into his cab, and he's just got this look on, she's just going a million miles an hour with her, you know, whatever it is she's saying, and he's just got this confused but also interested look on his face while she's, you know, painting a picture, so to speak, of what happened, and it's just like perfectly acted by him because maybe he wasn't acting.
I think that's love at first sight.
Yeah.
Although he was married to Demi Moore at the time, so.
Right.
I guess if anyone drops down behind me, even if I know it's coming, I'm still going to jump a little.
Yeah. Well, apparently Bruce's confusion was real because what I had read was that they didn't tell him what she was going to say when she fell into the cab. And so he just told her, you know, just start talking in the language and do your whole thing. And Bruce is just sitting there not sure what is happening. And so I think part of that was captured in that way. But I think part of it was like you said, it was just love at first sight. Yeah.
I think Mila doesn't look like she's putting in, it doesn't look effortful as an actor, even though she's being frenetic and she's saying what is seemingly gibberish, but obviously is crafted.
Yeah.
She's getting the words out in a way that the words sound like they're gibberish, but she's pretty articulate actually with it, with that much, that fast. That was impressive to me.
Yeah. And you totally buy it when she, you know, he's essentially going to hand her over to the cops, right? And she is able to piece out what please help is because she's so smart.
That is another quote that I use on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah.
Please help.
I'm like, how could you hear that and not go, all right, let's fight the cops?
It's a perfect puppy dog moment. Right. It's a perfect puppy dog.
It really is, right?
The eyes, the voice, the tone, everything.
Right. He just threw away his last little bit that he had, his final point on his license for this girl, just because she essentially bats her eyes and says, please help in the sweetest way possible. And Bruce, I don't think there's a guy that watches that movie that goes, what are you doing? Everyone goes, yeah, he's making the right decision.
Which brings us to the car chase.
Yeah.
Which is just a brilliant piece of cinematography. And I love everything with the McDonald's.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
It's great to show that these big corporations are still going to be around in 300 years.
Of course they are.
And the irony of the fact that the cops are getting McDonald's for lunch, and then the thing that stops them from continuing the chase is they crash into a McDonald's truck, and all of a sudden there's their lunch.
All over the place.
It's, again, brilliantly crafted film.
Yeah. And what's funny, and Brady, were you on the Judge Dredd episode? I don't remember.
No, I was not.
Okay, well, that was only 3 years earlier, okay? And the effects, and there was also a lot of, like, sky traffic and chases, and, they had the big, fat, stupid bikes. This looks so much better, just visually, than that did. And that was a giant budget Hollywood movie. And this was, you know, what it was. And it still holds up. And it was 1997. It's amazing to me.
Well, that scene does. There are other scenes like the aforementioned fire planet does not look great.
No.
And the whole scene where they're 3D printing Lilu also does not look great.
Well, her bones and especially her body pre-skin looks pretty old.
But that car chase scene, the graphics are amazing. And, you know, part of the reason behind that is because it wasn't, I mean, there was some CGI involved, but a lot of it was practical effects. Those are models that they built, like that entire city. His model that was built, and then they would even put little tiny pictures in the windows to show so you could look inside the windows.
Somebody out there has that model, and they play with it every day.
Well, I would. I absolutely would.
Hey, guys, want to come play with New York City in my basement? You can even look through, like, even the detail that was spent on the background. Like, when Lilu is speaking to Corbin, and you're just looking past him through his windshield into what's happening in the distance, and it all looks legit. In a movie like Judge Dredd, it was like there in front of a screen. What follows from here is where things start to crisscross a lot. And to me, it's a bit like how future Pirates of the Caribbean movies would be, where like this character gets handed off to this character, and then they're reluctantly together, but kind of enemies, and then this one double crosses the other one, and there's a lot of now starting to move the chess pieces around this movie, which I admit the first time I saw it when I was 18 years old, I found a bit confusing. The plot is much, and who is who and what everyone is trying to do and accomplish is much clearer to me now, But there's a lot of moving parts from just a pure plot standpoint.
Not to make fun of your age, but I am so jealous that you got to see this in theaters.
Yeah, I remember going to see it in the theater. That would have been my, so I was class of 97, it would have been my senior year in high school. And I don't know if I was with you, Brady, but we usually would go, me and Brady and a couple other guys. And I liked it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't believe I saw this in theaters. Like, and we were talking about box office numbers earlier. Obviously, a lot of people didn't go see this movie in the theaters. I just remember the marketing was horrible. Like once I saw it later, I was just like, oh my God, those marketing people did such a horrible job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was expecting Die Hard in space or something like that. Yeah. I just remember the marketing was a lot of the opera singer, and which kind of made it look like this weird, Murder on the Orient Express in space kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, no, I just remember the marketing was horrible.
It was. And that was back in the time when, if we liked somebody that was in it, we were going to the movies every weekend, right? And we're like, oh, hey, Bruce Willis is in a movie. Guess I'm going to go see this. And there'd be movies I'd go, I hadn't even seen a trailer for. Or, I mean, that never happens now. Like, you know everything about the movie before you go see it.
I can't stand that. It drives me nuts. I stay off the internet before a movie comes out because it's just not safe.
Yeah.
I like to be surprised.
So, Corbin takes Lilu to the priest, and Corbin is essentially off the hook, right? And we get this scene where the first sparks start to fly back when he's just watching her talk back in the cab. But there's this moment where he kisses her while she's unconscious, and immediately there's a gun to his head, which is very well acted and hilarious to me.
It's a classic Sleeping Beauty turned on its head moment. It's brilliant.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah.
He's like, okay.
You're right.
And then when he finds out what she said at the
ectogamut.
Very end. That's right.
Ectogamut. Never without my permission.
That's right. Yeah, it makes for a great moment.
I'm surprised it's not used more these days, frankly.
What's that?
That people aren't embracing, women aren't embracing that phrase.
Ectogamut?
Yeah, sure. Right?
Like, never again without my permission.
Right?
Yeah. For the 90s, I thought it was an awesome moment to have in this movie.
Yeah, I agree completely. And and it's just, especially because, like you said, it's the 90s. You don't really expect to see something that progressive at that time.
Right, because Bruce Willis especially had kind of been in those types of movies where it was like hit girl overhead, drag her back to cave, kind of, not literally. But yeah, no, that was a really cool moment. And it definitely, maybe given Bruce's persona and the type of films he had done to that point, made it even more unexpected when it happened.
I also think it does a lot to build Mila's character too, to show that she's not going to be just the damsel in distress. There's more to her.
Yeah. And I wish they had carried that through. I feel like it in the last 20 minutes, they maybe reneged on that a little bit.
They did drop it a little bit.
But so I wish they had seen that vision through. Maybe they caved to what, at the time they thought audiences or studios wanted to see. But I am glad that that's in there. I thought that was really well done. And so 47 minutes into the film, we meet Gary Oldman's character, Zorg. 47 minutes. That's almost halfway through the entire movie. And there hasn't been a bad guy other than the floating fire planet, right? And so we are introduced to, we now understand that it was him that sent the Mangalores to go shoot down the fat aliens. The Mendishawins.
I want to help you. I want to help you, but the other part of me says he has to learn on his own.
If he doesn't, we can all enjoy.
That's fine.
The
dark crystal thing. And so they have this great scene. This kind of serves also as our introduction to Gary Oldman's character, where he's basically doing this arms deal with the lip aliens and showing them. Well, basically is aimbot for real life.
The ZF-1 is the coolest gun in any media I have ever seen, ever.
Wow.
It does everything. Agreed.
From a function agreed. Standpoint. Okay, you agree. That's from a function standpoint, I'll agree with you. I don't think it looks like the coolest gun I've ever seen in any movie ever.
No. I will give you that. Visually, yeah. It's not that appealing, but no. Just everything it can do is really cool.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Where he just starts firing and the bullets are going behind him, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. And it's got a net and rocket launchers. And I don't know why I laugh every time. Every time I see the darts just fly into the dummy's face, I laugh to myself. It's just such a funny thing.
And who doesn't love the brand new ice cube system?
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Do you like guns, Nicole?
Not a lot. So.
You mean you weren't sitting there watching the scene going, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen?
The sweet piece. No, just no.
I'm just saying if Nerf ever came out with that, they'd make billions.
I'd throw my wallet at them.
And then they wouldn't sell it to you because that's rude.
That's true.
So why did Gary Oldman's hair have to look like that?
You mean the egg with the tuft of hair on top, the Homer Simpson egg?
Yeah. There's a lot of great design in the whole film, and they're really being avant-garde a lot of ways. But that particular part, I think I don't even see the character choosing it. I think that's my issue with it. I just, for some reason, don't feel it. Or his character, but I'm not him, of course.
I think I can answer this question.
Please.
The simplest answer I can give is the costume designer for this movie is most famous for designing Madonna's cone bra.
No way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every 14-year-old girl ever, well, probably not anymore, but like would get two cups and like practice that at some point and like figure it out. So
does everything make a little more sense costume-wise now?
Yes. Thank you.
You just like unlocked my brain to the whole thing now. Yeah. That all makes more sense. Yeah, that was a weird choice. But not even the most frustrating thing about his character. He's often praised for this performance, and I think it was good. I hated his accent.
No.
I did. I didn't. I guess it just didn't make any sense to me that he'd be like a space hillbilly. I mean, he sounded like somebody from like Kentucky.
I think I agree with you. I wasn't sure about it. He's obviously like a fantastic actor.
He was intense.
And the accent.
Yeah.
Are you saying people from Kentucky can't be intelligent, evil masterminds?
I'm just saying, did he grow up in Kentucky? And now he's like, why does he have the accent? If he grew up on a spaceship somewhere, I don't know.
Let's look at it this way. Have you never in film or media seen a rich Southern accented villain?
I'm sure. I'm guessing I have.
That's Dukes of Hazzard comes to mind.
Roots.
Yeah, but they were. But Dukes of Hazzard was in the South.
Okay, that.
I guess I like.
But you're right. You're right. People can't move.
No. I'm not saying that. But like, if Grand Moff Tarkin had come out in Star Wars and he sounded like he was, you know, from Texas, I think it would have been a little jarring. Is all I'm saying.
Maybe because nobody else has anything like that in the film. There was right. no slow crescendo.
At this point, there could be like a whole system of inhabited planets where like the major, you know, the first colonists or whatever were from Alabama. We don't know this. You know, entire planets where they have Southern accents.
And let's not forget, this is a foreign film. So whereas in our films,
that's true.
The bad guys are always either British or German with British accents.
Touché.
Oh, okay. Touché. Now that is probably the best argument I've heard.
So in conclusion, we are saying that the accent has its own integrity and place in our society.
Yes.
But in the film, for some reason, it just struck me as out of place
In a space movie. Yeah. It's not that people that have that accent can't be heads of major corporations or whatever this, I don't even know what this guy's job is, right?
I've watched this movie so many times. I've never associated his act. I've never really associated with him having an accent. I've never thought of it as a Southern accent.
Honestly, so neither.
I'll just throw that out.
Like
there.
I noticed that it is an accent. I've never really been like, that's a Southern accent.
Well, I know, cause he's British. Like Gary doesn't speak like that himself, right? And so he's affecting an accent.
I don't think you can ever possibly know how Gary Oldman sounds because he has a different voice every time he talks.
That's true.
But the character's first name is Jean-Baptiste. So let's just note that.
Makes
Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg.
Which
he's from Emmanuel. Southern France.
The portal to Southern France.
Oh, okay, so he's a Southern French hillbilly.
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Okay. All right. I'll do whatever mental gymnastics I have to do, because I do enjoy his performance. This is all not to say
so much.
I didn't like him. It's just I acknowledge I'm nitpicking. His motivations aren't really clear in this scene, because immediately you're thinking, well, why on earth would anybody be trying to support this giant flaming planet ball and wanting it to do whatever it's going to do? It doesn't seem to make any sense. And I guess when he meets with Ian Holm's character in a incredibly acted scene between the two of them, he goes on some kind of rant about how destruction is going to make him money.
Well, the idea of his entire argument is that he and the priest, Vito Cornelius, are on the same side. They're both on the side of life, because destruction begets life. And I hate to say it, he's not wrong. It's kind of like a forest fire, you know, you need it for new growth. But he's really twisted in the way he goes about it.
Yeah, super, super duper twisted, which is an interesting motivation from the normal villain in a sci-fi movie, which is just like evil for evil's sake.
It's kind of Thanos-esque.
Honestly. Exactly. That's what I was waiting to say.
Yeah.
It's, you know, every villain is the hero of their own story, right?
Right.
I will say, I don't think that's the case for Zorg. I think we later on, when we see him talking to who he refers to as Mr. Shadow, we see that his motivation is purely greed.
Yeah.
He says his costs have tripled. And of course, the darkness or whatever it is says money is not important.
Yeah. And I was kind of shocked to find out that Gary Oldman's not a fan of the Fifth Element. He does not
I just lost a lot of respect for him.
Yeah. In fact, he called it dreadful. He was in an interview and he said, basically he equated it to him singing for his supper in this movie, because Luc Besson had financed another film that he wanted to do, make like a pet project of Gary's. And the quid pro quo was, I said that wrong, was that he would come and do the Fifth Element. So he viewed it as singing for his supper, and he's never gone back to watch it. And he finds the whole thing dreadful, which is really disappointing.
Well, I will say this much, at least, knowing that, I'm just glad he didn't phone it in, because he didn't.
No.
At all.
He at least had the professional respect of Luke's to say, I'll give you everything I've got, even though maybe he felt like it wasn't worth his time.
Maybe he was trying to say that craft services were really poor on the film.
I did love that, from a character moment standpoint, played beautifully by Gary. After that great scene with Ian, when he's choking on the cherry, and Ian just with utter disdain in his eyes as he's talking, I mean, just masterful acting on his part, gets the cherry out of his mouth, and as they're dragging him off, he says, you're a monster, Zorg. And that moment where Gary just said, acknowledges it, right? And says, I know. Great moment in the movie.
Absolutely.
I just want to go ahead and point out that weird alien in that scene.
Yeah.
They named it Picasso.
What? The elephant?
The elephant. Thing? The little tiny elephant thing. Yeah. It's Picasso.
Okay.
Sure.
Any reason why? No?
No, I maybe, but I don't know it.
That's a deep cut, man. That's how you know that you really love this movie. And it's interesting that Gary almost seemed like he was above this type of movie, because he would go on to do lots of franchise movies, right? He did Batman, he did Harry Potter, he did RoboCop. What else was he in?
Man, smush those movies together. That's an amazing film.
He did a Planet of the Apes movie, right? So he filled out his filmography with, you know, these kind of summer tentpole things, but I don't know why he just doesn't love this one. So everyone finds out basically that the stones are on Folston Paradise, right? And they have the scene where they're all trying to individually move their chess pieces in a way where they'll be the ones that end up with the ticket to Folston Paradise.
The quick cuts in this film are just incredible.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, it's a little earlier. It's when Zorg is trying to sell the guns to the Mangalores, and they're supposed to bring in the box with four stones in him. They open it up and he says, this case is empty.
Yeah.
And, I'm not blanking on exactly how the scene goes out, but it's switching back and forth constantly between Zorg and Lilu, and the dialogue matches up perfectly. Everything matches up perfectly, and it's just brilliantly put together. I keep using the term brilliantly, but
it's true. And Luke is kind of shows his skill at this, because he does this many times in this movie. This is one of those where he's intercutting between multiple things, and he's the timing of it all, along with the music, especially later during the Diva concert, where they're timing up the fight scene with what's happening there, and he's cutting back and forth. He's he's really good at that type of filmmaking, and I think that definitely shines through here. And the military basically rigs the contest to get Corbin there. The priest's plan is to incapacitate Corbin and take his pass and go with Lilu. The Mangalores kidnap who they think is Corbin because Corbin made it look like the guy next to him was, you know.
That was Lilo.
Lilu did that. Lilu did that. And so they disguise themselves as who they think is Corbin. And then Gary Oldman, I'm trying to remember, how does he...
He sends his henchmen, because the reason the police go there to begin with is because the henchman gives a clue that this Corbin Dallas guy has got something to do with a weapons deal or something like that.
Right, so this is what I mean when there's like just tons of moving pieces from a plot standpoint, right? And everyone's coming together at the same time and all trying to get on the same space shuttle to get out of Dodge, mm-hmm. and it culminates in this airport scene.
I do want to cut in here real quick
because
there is another one of those absolutely brilliant lines that I say on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah.
And this one is a little out there, but I love when he's got his hands against the wall and they're like, "Are you human?" And he responds with, "Negative, I am a meat popsicle."
Yeah, that was very Bruce Willis, yeah. Right? And I know he likes to throw in, and in hearing interviews, he's always trying to pepper in these like sarcastic comments. I wonder if that was his.
I do also have to mention, because it was specifically requested by a friend of mine,
yes.
when they found out that I was coming on here to talk about this, that I absolutely have to mention the moment when the priest knocks out Corbin Dallas with the metal, and just the face that Bruce Willis makes and the kind of, oh, that he does is just so right. over the top You're and right. ridiculous.
It was a choice.
It deserves an honorable mention.
He made a strong choice, right? Bruce doesn't know how to act like getting knocked out because he never gets knocked out, right? So to him, he's probably unsure of how to do that exactly.
Hans Gruber would not.
No. And this is another weird thing that happens in the scene that I thought, and maybe the first time I saw it, I didn't realize the dude was in a scene later. I thought the guy in the refrigerator was dead.
No, the general shows up multiple times.
Right? Did you think the same thing, Brady?
Yeah, I'm just like, so is that the joke here that these people are dead?
Right, it was such a dark twist.
There's another moment where you're not sure if someone's dead or not.
Right, exactly.
It's that darn auto wash.
they You got this guy frozen, and then she's getting soaked in the auto wash, and it was a very confusing scene, but one that I think ultimately pays off. And this poor flight attendant has got all these people coming up saying they're Corbin Dallas. It's played for great comedic effect. And then you have Mila delivering maybe my favorite moment from her in the entire movie. What does she say when she walks up to the flight attendant? You told me you were going to say this 100 times on this podcast.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Lilu Multipass.
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 Yes, she knows. Multipass. She knows it's a multipass. Anyway, we're in love.
Multipass.
Right? She just keeps holding it up.
With the eyebrows above her head.
Yes.
Multipass.
It's such a great, sweet moment. We get on the plane, and we're introduced to Ruby Rod, Chris Tucker, and then in parentheses, I just have... Because... I know it's coming, and every time he kills me in this movie.
It's just his movements too, just all the unnecessary spinning and twirling and crouching right. and jumping. And I also need to take this moment to talk about the cigarettes in this movie.
Yes,
the filters are longer than
right. The actual cigarette is like
a couple centimeters,
right?
Which I think is just hilarious.
Absolutely.
Well, they might be growing some really potent stuff.
Maybe
I suppose
space. Perhaps, but he man when he. Pace, when he turns with both of his shoulders.
Commitment.
He is like, he is great.
Everyone in this movie is having a blast. Everyone.
I just keep thinking except about the guy Oldman. Holding the boom and like the, everybody back there being like, what? Okay, he's over. Okay. Yep, okay. Got it. And, he's
over there. Now he's over
yep,
here.
Yep. Just
and
amazing.
He what's great about his performance is he fully commits.
Yes.
100% yeah. because he's dressed effeminately, okay? And but he's very masculine, his character, right? He's, you know, taking down flight attendant after flight attendant, okay? And for him, as an actor, I'm like, this is a weird needle to thread. And you can only do it if you're going to go full go and not be self-conscious
yeah.
about what you're doing.
They originally wanted right. Prince.
Prince.
Exactly.
Prince would have been perfect, but I think Chris Tucker is... way funnier than Prince would.
Oh, I would agree. I think Prince would have done it a little too seriously.
Yes.
And Chris Tucker, while he still does it seriously, there is definitely, I mean, he's got the comedic timing that that Chris Tucker has.
Chris does this like mumble thing when he talks. Come on, what's going on? Come on. Hey, like, you're right. And it's just, it's hilarious to me.
The thing about this character is it's the most over the top character, but he's also playing the voice of the audience of like calling out what's going on and asking the obvious questions. So like, you know, Bruce Willis is supposed to be the straight man, right?
Right.
But he's too busy being the action hero. So you have this weird flamboyantly over the top person being the straight man in the movie. And it's just, it's insane how he's like the comic relief and the straight man at the same time.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. He's got to thread this weird needle that it's not what a normal, I guess when you're in a film, a normal Hollywood film, you kind of know your character and the purpose that it serves within this movie. And this movie is full of things that kind of go against that. And from an acting standpoint, might make it more difficult.
I think it's a commentary too on celebrity overall and how insulated they become sometimes if they're off.
Oh yeah.
Separate from everything else. Yeah. They don't know really how to handle regular situations, but this is not regular.
When he's got his little crew of guys, right? That every time he finishes, he just lights a cigarette and he goes, okay, tell me how good I was.
Oh, so green. Right. Super green.
So super green.
And what's whatever the green? Kind of green you like.
That's the green.
I don't
That's
know.
Just in the future how you say things are cool.
Yeah.
I have to go back just one topic about when you were saying, so Chris Tucker was playing the feminine and the masculine, but killing bad dudes doesn't always mean that you're masculine though. You could be like super feminine and kick some serious behind.
Well, 100%. And that's not what I meant by that at all.
Lilu, for instance.
I just meant like
duh.
Right. Lilu, for instance, right?
Right.
But
wearing dresses and
the way he dresses and maybe he doesn't have a preference, right? But the fact that I didn't expect to see him betting stewardesses is all I'm trying to say.
He's on a continuum, man. He puts himself
that's what I'm saying.
That day.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And he, when he gets up in that stewardess's face and he's just, I can't even tell what the heck he's saying.
You got to have subtitles on to hear it.
Right? I don't know.
But yeah, he gets in there and he's like, your man, my man, 5 to 7.
Right. Whatever he's saying. And she's literally just, he's just saying words to her and she's, well, you know.
Yeah. Yep. I love the part a little later on when he's interacting with another stewardess and
the landing
and
gear.
She's like, "Are you sure?" And he's like, "I swear, I've never felt this way about another human before."
Oh, right. Yeah. So maybe he doesn't care.
Yeah.
Whatever. Well, this goes into, we meet the diva. The diva comes in, and as you've already said, it's Luc Besson's wife or girlfriend at the time. And
I'm not sure which. I know they got divorced like two years later or something like that.
But. Yeah. And now she was dubbed. That wasn't her voice.
That was not
voice.
Her. That was, I have it written
down. It's a famous soprano, I think, right?
Inva Mula
Is
the name of the voice for Pava Laguna.
And so apparently the music that they wrote and gave to her wasn't humanly possible for her to sing.
So I have heard.
Right.
Yeah. And yet.
So there were some points where they recorded some of the notes individually and then put them together after the fact because it just...
It's impossible. The fact that she was just jumping notes so high. I bet there's someone out there. If Mariah Carey can sing to the moon with one note, then...
Well, right. I mean,
goes so high.
Humans just keep progressing. So maybe now, 25 years later, there's somebody that can do it. But at least at the time, they were like, nope, I can't do this. But...
Yeah, my jaw just drops during
the
part.
It's incredible. And Bruce, again, another real reaction because this is the first time with a shot that they had seen her in makeup and they played the music and all that stuff. And he had said he was just actually dumbfounded by what he was looking at.
Well, I mean, he's a musician too, if you can call it that.
Sure.
But so he at least has an appreciation for music.
Yes, absolutely. And then Corbin gets the stones literally from the diva, one of the grossest parts of the movie.
How does it,
they're big stones.
Yeah, and as a singer, how did the resonance, how is she still able to sing so well? But regularly, was there surgery? Did she just like use her mind and get them in there? How were they placed in there?
She is a big question mark in this film because honestly, like there's some sort of like aliens.
That's
aliens.
That's right.
Brady. Aliens.
That's
just wave it away. Aliens.
Wave it away.
But yeah, there's some big question marks there because like is she telepathic? Does she what's going on there?
Yeah.
Like, it's
Yeah, it's not really, really made clear. I wonder if it's if her look and everything was like an homage to Alien, in that her head, the tubes, like she was almost like a pretty version of
she's
a xenomorph.
She's a beautiful xenomorph.
Yeah, exactly. Like I wonder if, because there was a lot of people even from the Alien franchise that were in the movie as actors as well. Like Ian Holm,
for instance.
Was one. And then there were some others as well. One of the cops that was in the chase was from one of the Alien movies. And so.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if that was what his intention was there, because
maybe
it looked like it. Now, if she had been singing and all of a sudden another mouth had come out from her other
and
mouth
started and singing.
Started singing more.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Hello, my ragtime girl.
Check, please. Yeah. So, but then they break out of this all out action sequence. And this is the stuff that Bruce doesn't even have to try at, right? He's such a natural at it. You immediately buy it. It's believable. Here's what I'll say about, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about Bruce's performance as such. I feel like this might've been one of the last movies he cared you see him now. I feel like it doesn't seem like he really cares anymore, or that he's kind of sleepwalking through his movies in the last 20 years. This seemed to be like, when he actually cares, he can give a great performance.
I would argue that he also did really, really well in Unbreakable and its follow-up movies.
Yeah, but even Unbreakable was the year 2000.
Oh, so it wasn't right? really that far after.
It wasn't even that far after this, right? Admittedly, I haven't seen, I never saw Mr. Glass, the sequel. So
it's confusing, but good.
Okay. Well, Bruce does his action movie thing. He negotiates with the Mangalores.
I would also argue, earlier it was said there's no yippee-ki-yays, but I think the line, anybody else want to negotiate, is pretty cool.
That's his 80s action movie one-liner they had to put in there, right? I think they're contractually obligated to give him at least one.
I also want to throw out this cool little tidbit regarding the Floss in Paradise shootout. When he throws the little spike grenade into the ceiling or the balcony where the other Mangalores are standing, that is, at that time, the largest explosion that was done on a soundstage, and it actually shut down production because the fire got out of control and they had to evacuate the soundstage.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Film is exciting.
The other thing I think I appreciate about this movie is there's some legitimately funny comedy in this movie. Like the joke with Chris Tucker when he sees the bomb on the door. Right? And he's just he's like, what is this?
No,
right?
No, no, no.
Hey, my man.
There's a bomb, because all these hotels have bomb detectors, right? And the alarm would have gone off, and then immediately the alarm goes off.
And even a little bit later, he's like, come on, man, you do this, right? Come on. And Corbin's just looking at it. And then the next shot is them just running out of the room.
Right.
Panicking.
Exactly. But what a great moment. Zorg dies kind of unceremoniously for a villain in a big sci-fi movie.
I argue not. I argue that this is perfect karma.
Considering earlier, the first scene he's in.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the first scene, he's talking about lip monsters. What were they called again?
Mangalores.
The Mandalorians.
Yes.
Mangalores. Okay. Yeah.
The Mangos.
Yeah. So the Mangos. He's talking about how they're all about honor and whatnot, and how he's like, there's nothing. What's the deal with honor? How's that important?
Right.
And then that's how he dies, because, for honor.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
What a
perfect
great
karma.
Great moment when he goes from relief to the other bomb just rises up out of that other case.
Oh, no.
Right? Now, to me, the best, this is a total side note, I'll do this quick because I know we're running out of time, but the most well-acted that anyone's ever done that scene where you realize a bomb is about to go off and you're about to die is Jeff Daniels in Speed. Okay. Do you remember that? When he walks into that, that house and they realize there's a bomb, and the face he makes, perfect. No one's ever done it better. Not Gary Oldman, not anybody, but it was still well done. I just got to throw Jeff. I don't think we'll ever do Speed on a movie or a bad movies podcast. So I got to take my chance.
You
could
do Speed too, though.
Oh, Cruise Control is definitely going to happen at some point.
Do you think Floss in Paradise was called that as Lost in Paradise? Is that an obvious thing, or is that just where my mind goes?
I've never thought of that before. I think you might be onto something there, but I've never caught that.
Yeah, I think a light bulb just went off in my brain when you said that. That's got to be what that is. Because otherwise, it's just a random thing. Like,
they're cleaning their teeth properly in a really nice place.
Floss in Paradise is not as nice as Folsom.
That's a cool band name.
It's probably taken, right?
It's like a poster in the dentist's office.
That's right.
They take Lilu back to Earth. A little bit of a nitpick. Basically, from the time they rescue her from the air duct until the end, she's pretty much incapacitated. This is what I mean about they didn't follow through with... I mean, she offered nothing pretty much at that point as far as helping them. I mean, obviously, she accomplished the thing at the end when they finally had their moment of connection. But I really would have liked to have seen her be a bigger contributor in the last 20 minutes.
I agree with you. I think because the way they built up her character would have been nice to have more. And she and Zork, that's kind of that bad guy showdown that you get where the bad guy actually wins that one.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, because of the nature of her and of her importance to the movie, they kind of had to take her out of commission thematically for the rest of it to make sense. Otherwise, where's the struggle with trying to figure out the stones if she can just be like, this is how you do it?
Yeah, I guess that's a really good point, Jesse. I think you're right. I think, and I realize it's a nitpick. It didn't make a lot of sense because she was kind of unconscious, but then she was awake enough to watch the war thing on the screen, and then in the next scene, she's unconscious again, right? And it's like, well, did she get shot in that air duct? Because it didn't appear like she was, so...
There is blood coming off of her when Corbin pulls her out. I think she's, based on what I watched last night, and I was paying super close attention to this because that's always been something that bothered me too.
Right.
I think she was shot in the shoulder, arm, upper chest region.
Right.
Like by the clavicle maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah,
so not like something that's major.
She could have shot some space lasers or something.
Something. Once. But it did give us a really incredible sequence where they're all trying to figure out... Coffin, I got no fire, man.
We're all going to die.
But the funniest part in the whole movie is, what you screaming for?
Yeah.
Right, it just scares him.
Everybody is just about something. I'm leaving.
Oh, it's good. But man, what an incredible moment. Although I don't know what kind of sense it makes, Bruce and her there. The conversation, I was really trying to make sense of what they were saying to each other. I don't know if it was just the best they could do to get to a point where they should kiss, right? And which ultimately is that expression of love that saves everything. But I don't care that it doesn't make any sense what they're saying to each other because I loved it.
I think it's a really good representation of most men's fear of intimacy.
Yeah.
Like he's afraid to say, I love you. And yet he absolutely has to because, A, he does, and, B, that's how they're going to stop this giant flaming meteor moon thing.
Yeah.
I found it a little confusing if it's supposed to be like a God figure and then it's like a romantic relationship. I'll use the word sacrilegious. That's not the right word. But it didn't seem to totally make sense to me that that's the way to get to it.
Right. Is that how they did it 5,000 years before?
Well, I just...
I don't know.
Probably. I mean, we're conflating the term supreme being with a god type creature. I mean, obviously this is not a god type creature, but it is a supreme being, right?
Right. I get what you're saying.
200,000 nano groups.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, slightly greasy solar atoms. Yeah.
Well, gods don't hook up with Bruce Willis in a tube, so I guess this isn't not necessarily a god, but I think you're right. And that's how they decide to end the movie with Lilu and Bruce Willis hooking up inside a tube. Very romantic.
Yeah. I guess that's what I'm getting at. Like the vibe didn't seem quite reverent enough.
Right. I get what you're saying.
I don't know. You could also say that they end the movie with Bruce Willis's dad or mom calling the president an idiot.
Right. That's true. Why don't you just suffocate me in bed or whatever it was she said. Man.
I wish I never pushed you out of the womb.
That's right. All right, guys. Well, this movie I feel like could have been super cheesy, and I think while it's elevated by some great performances
and brilliant filmmaking,
I guess what I want to ask you guys is it elevated because of the performances or because Luke is such a great writer? Is that what usually makes, as both of you are actors, is that what makes a good performance? Because I was really thinking about this last night. Like, has anyone ever given a bad performance in a Tarantino movie? Right? If the writing is good enough, is performance less important? Where does the credit lie? Is it with Luke or the cast?
I actually give Luke a lot of credit.
Yeah?
Even as an actor to say that, but if the material that you have is great, it's less difficult to mess it up, right?
Yeah.
So I think he did a really great job with it. And obviously he picked, well, the casting picked people who did a fantastic job too. So
yeah.
It had to start there though.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. I think it's really easy to perform good material and it's really hard to perform bad material.
Yeah. I would agree. I've seen people elevate crap, but it's
still
hard.
Crap.
And generally you still have an uneven movie. There might be one great performance in it, but overall the whole cast isn't going to necessarily elevate a bad script.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And then there's the question of script versus being there in person and pulling it out, right?
Right.
A directing part of it, which is like that middle part. Because I haven't seen the actual paper of it, the script, but maybe it's that connectedness between them as they created art.
No, I agree. This is something I think I've always wondered about. But I think the so much of it is done before the actor even shows up on set that determines whether or how good, or at least not that a good script's never been sunk by wrong casting or bad performance, because it probably has, but I feel like you're set up for success more so with as long as you're starting with a great script. So I guess I'm agreeing with you that Luke deserves the majority of the credit here.
We'll say 62%.
62-38.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's give out some awards really quick. Every episode on Bad Movies Rule, we give out some flowers to these movies that maybe didn't get a lot from the mainstream critics. So we're going to give them the praise and shower them with laurels right here on this podcast. So we give out an award called the Will Patton Award on this podcast, where it's for someone who was in maybe a smaller part that really was bringing in 110% from a bit player, not one of what you'd say the main cast members. So to you, who was somebody in a smaller role that really was throwing fireballs out there from a performance standpoint? Brady, you got somebody for the Will Patton Award?
I have two in mind, but I'm going to go with David, the assistant priest.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Was that guy in Galaxy Quest?
Yeah, no, you're thinking of Justin Long.
Okay.
He's very similar to Justin Long, but no, that's Justin Long in Galaxy Quest.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that's a really good pick. That's really good. If you have yours, go ahead and speak. I'm really thinking between two.
Oh, I've got it.
Okay, go ahead.
The absolute, what's the name of the award?
The Will Patton Award.
Will Patton. This is the Will Patton Award winner for this movie.
Okay.
It is the guy who tries to hijack Bruce Willis right at the beginning of the movie. He's wearing the hat that makes it look like the outside of the hallway.
Yes.
And he does his little dance. He's just given that 110, 150%.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
And he's just got that one small little scene. Hands down.
He's the winner.
I can't.
All right. That. We're not going to beat that. He's going to be the winner. All right. We also like to rank our top three performances, so I want you guys to think through the movie. And if you had to rank, okay, out of all, and in this movie it's hard because there's probably 10 or 15 performances that are really good. What you would think were the top three performances from an acting standpoint in this movie? I'll go first while you guys think it over. I think number one is going to be, I'm going to say her name wrong again, Mila.
That's it. Just call her Mila. You got
Mila.
It.
Mila.
Yeah.
That's still Lilu. Wrong.
Is that still wrong?
It's Mia.
Mia.
The L's are
I'm thinking
silent.
Of Mila Kunis.
You're. Well, I think she might be Mia too, honestly.
Oh,
but
I thought she was Mila.
Mia Jovovich is.
Mia Jovovich.
She's Russian.
Mia Jovovich is number one. Not only did I think she had the hardest part to play, she not only took the what was, you know, the hardest material, maybe the most. I mean, it wasn't on the page from a dialogue standpoint, so she had to do the most off the page, so to speak. But she really, really went for it. I think Ian Holm would be number two for me. He was funny when he needed to be funny. He was super intense when he needed to be intense. And a great performance, I think, maybe gets overlooked in this movie a lot. I'm going to give Lee Evans number three. Lee Evans was the guy, as you said, the guy from Mouse Hunt, or the guy that played the dude on crutches and Something About Mary, the pizza delivery man. He was like the little Fog, I think was his name in this movie, the security guy.
Officer.
Yeah. Obviously, there were probably better performances, but I love that guy. And he was having a moment in the 90s. He was like in everything. And I love that guy. So, but if not him, Bruce Willis, number three. Okay, sorry. Who wants to go next?
I'll go next. And honestly, I agree with you somewhat. Like, I'm going to say Mila Jovovich definitely is the top. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how anyone could top her in this movie. Just all the stuff that she had to do and the way and the lines that she had to deliver and the seriousness with which she delivered them. I mean, how can you not love it when an actress can go up to dump out an entire plate of chicken bones, put on some fish flakes on a plate, throw it in what looks like a microwave, reheat it, and just go, chicken, good.
You do that and so do it well.
Such straight. I have had a lot of practice. That's another one that I say a lot. Anytime yeah. I see chicken, that's yeah. my go-to line.
That's good.
So Mila Jovovich is my number one, and I'm actually gonna Ian Holm's in there too, but he's mm-hmm. actually number three because for okay. me number two is Gary Oldman.
Oh, okay, all right. I don't think anybody could argue with that. He's even though he's a space hillbilly, he did a really really good job. Right. Even every time his hair got in his face, I was like, oh, masterful.
It's a character in itself.
That's right.
Man, so this is really hard for me because yeah. I appreciate so many of these actors' work. And so I'm going to plead the fifth element and not rank them. But I've already said so much that obviously yeah. there's just been so much good commitment to character. And yeah. I've been impressed overall.
Okay. Brady?
I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not going to say number one. We all know who number one is.
I think it's unanimous.
It's yeah, you woman in this.
I want to put Chris Tucker in number two.
Okay.
I think if that's Prince, this movie doesn't do as well.
Yeah.
Right.
He's threading that needle, right?
Right.
So he's important to the film.
Yeah.
And then Gary Oldman is number three because what a great bad guy.
Yeah. He was great. And just to close this out, I want to throw a couple of casting what ifs at you guys. These are some of the people that were almost playing these parts just to get your initial reaction to this. So besides Prince, Jamie Foxx was almost Ruby Rod.
Oh,
how would that?
That would have been bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Horrible.
So they went with Chris because he was skinnier. They just thought Jamie was too thick. That was literally what decided that. Between the two of them.
I don't know. I can see him knocking it out.
Yeah?
He's done a lot of different stuff. Right. I can see it.
Mel Gibson was up for Corbin Dallas. If Bruce had, because at one point Bruce, they thought, was going to say no. He was playing footsie with him a little bit. And so then they were starting to go to Mel. And then Bruce was like, no, I'll do it. So Mel, but now remember, this is talking about 90s yeah. Mel Gibson.
And he was playing that kind of character.
Like the biggest star on the planet at that time.
I think he could have done it, but I also think he might have taken it too seriously.
Yeah. No, I don't think, although he's shown comedic chops, maybe he hasn't done any sci-fi. That's the thing. I don't know maybe why in my brain I can't compute.
Yeah, I can't see Braveheart in space.
Yeah. So General Monroe, that was the guy that got frozen in the refrigerator, right? Kevin Costner was considered for that part at one point, which maybe they would have expanded it into a bigger part if it had been Kevin. But I think Kevin in the 90s was... should have either been up for Corbin or that's it, right?
I could see him as Corbin Dallas. I do think Bruce Willis still did better than he would have done, but
yeah,
for General Monroe, that's such a bit part.
Yeah, I think they cast the right person. I don't think there's anybody that plays the part better than Bruce. Underrated, at least at that
point. Oh my God, his facial expressions are priceless throughout the whole movie.
This is the one. This is the barn burner. I saved this one for last. If not Mia, they were going to ask Julia Roberts to play... Jesse just took off his glasses and put his head down. He's so upset about that. Could you imagine Julia Roberts in this role?
Don't get me wrong. I love Julia Roberts. I think she's an incredible actress.
Yeah.
And she's got an amazing skill.
Yeah.
But no, under no circumstances could anybody other than Mia Jovovich have played this.
And
this
for
part.
Me, I think the disconnect would have been the way that Mila, now I'm afraid to say her name anymore, right? But moved her body. It was just like kind of a slinky sometimes and moved so much. And I've seen Julia Roberts being in positions, I mean, even in Pretty Woman, when she was wearing less, she still stayed pretty upright and pretty rigid.
Right.
And And I think that rigidity might have taken away.
I don't think she had the physicality to pull the part off.
That was a way simpler way to say what I was
trying to
say.
No. Well, only because I had the benefit of listening to you say it and then I could just, you know, parrot it back to you. But all that to say, I think you're absolutely correct. She's too stiff. This really required somebody to, with a certain, also like, what's the word? Lack of shame.
Yeah.
And like, maybe she would have been too concerned image wise to do it as dirty. I don't mean that as like dirty, but you know what I mean? Like get down and
hair
dirty
all
and
messed up
yeah, right. Yeah. And be kind of crazy and all that. So no, she's absolutely wrong for that part. Well, I want to thank you guys for joining us today on Bad Movies Rule for Nicole Freer and Jesse Hurst and Brady Cox. This is James Hauser. We appreciate you guys being here. Come join us next week when we're going to be talking about Mega Force, the 1982 action movie starring Barry Bostick, of all people. You want to watch Barry Bostick run around in spandex in the desert shooting laser guns? Mega Force is the movie. So come join us next week. Thank you guys for coming. I appreciate it very much.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to have you guys back again. Brady, we'll talk to you soon. Have a good night, everybody.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.